Welcome everyone to the Friends That Carry On podcast, where we dive deeper into our trips, unpack tips, and everything in between. Now sit back, relax, and get ready to go on a trip with your favourite group of friends.
Hello and welcome to the Friends That Carry On podcast. We are a group, as a lot of y'all know, of friends who get together and like to travel the world and try to create FOMO within our friends and others and hopefully inspire others to travel. In doing so, we like to live by our motto that life don't suck. Today, we're actually also going to be introducing our sister company, which is Octave Hospitality and Travel Industry Advisors. And we do a lot of consulting for the travel industry. A lot of times it's financial consulting, workforce development, operations, and leadership development. And the reason we're introducing that today, which I'm going to be introducing our guests in a little bit, is we're going to lead in with some of that leadership development. But anyhow, so that's an introduction there. You can find us, the Friends That Carry On, at friendsthatcarryon.com and Octave at octavehospitality.com, and we'll give you more information on that later. Today, we are very happy to have a pretty special speaker. Jeff Patnode is our speaker today, and Jeff is the author of 7 books on leadership and mentoring and 25 children's books. Jeff is also a teacher, speaker, composer, business leader, and executive mentor. He's been recognized as one of the pioneers in bringing together the marketplace of spirit and work. Jeff's focus and professional dedication for 3 decades has centered on the most pressing issues facing our culture today: work-life flow, developing mentors for the greater good, creating healthy work environments where people thrive, and teaching and coaching others towards developing them as transformational leaders. Having trained and mentored over 40,000 business leaders in multiple organizations, he has been described as the Leonard Bernstein of leadership development and gained an international reputation for his ability to orchestrate environments for transformation. I'd like to welcome Jeff Patnode.
Thank you, Jim. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you. I want to start by saying I met Jeff, or how I came to meet Jeff, and have worked with him for the last several years. We, in 2016, as a lot of y'all know, we're located in West Virginia. Floods ravaged the lower part of the state. And at that time, I was involved with a group that was working on some education initiatives, and then the floods came through. So we were looking for ways to help the state. And we came in contact with a lady who I had just met at that time and who's become a good friend, Kathleen McNally, or Dr. Kathleen McNally. And we were looking for people who knew West Virginians that might have some deep pockets that could help contribute. And she had known Jeff from like 10 years prior and hadn't talked to him in like 10 years and reached out to him on the chance that she might take his call because she knew that Jeff had worked with Cisco. And Cisco's chairman of the board and CEO at that time was John Chambers, who was a West Virginia native. So anyhow, Kathleen reached out, and Jeff, you know, like I said, he hadn't talked to her in 10 years, and very graciously invited Kathleen, myself, and another one of our members, Alicia Maddox, to his farm in Warrenton, Virginia. So we went there. He was a gracious host, invited us there for the weekend, and then started sharing some of his wisdom and so forth. And then that led to us starting a nonprofit a year or so later and doing mentoring with high school students in West Virginia. So always been real appreciative. I consider him a mentor to me. And in today's environment, transformational leadership and emotional intelligence is a very important part of normal everyday life. And now with our current environment, with the coronavirus and businesses being shut down and so forth, learning to deal with the stresses and the pressures that's going on, it's maybe even more so important. So before we get into how Jeff helps do that, Jeff, I'd like, if you could, just kind of share your history, how you got started. I know you started off as an ordained Episcopal minister, but how it kind of evolved into to the work you do today.
Thanks, Jim. Be glad to. Leadership's always been a part of my DNA. I recently heard from one of my sisters that they attended a musical production at the local high school, and it was done by the Burgoyne Company of Drama. And that was a summer stock theater company that I started when I was 16 years old in my little town in upstate New York, where we did not have theater. And so at the age of, well, an early age, I marshaled forces together and started a company that's, gosh, what, it's been almost, well, 55 years. It's remained and still goes today. I have a summer camp program for kids that's coming up on its 50th year in five more years, where my wife and I are going to go back as chaplain and dean, and more than 30,000 kids have gone through that program, including my children, who went there first in a bassinet and grew up to become counselors. It's called BREAD, and it's touched the lives of so many thousands of kids. It's just a marvelous thing. So leadership has always been a part of my life. My own parish ministry, which I was very involved in for 18 years in Silicon Valley, was a large parish eventually. It didn't start out that way, but we had a leadership school there. And I said that if you're going to be in charge of any kind of commission, you have to go through leadership training. That didn't sit well with a lot of church leaders because they thought, you're lucky I'm volunteering. But it became really the foundation of service that people thought, this is the most amazing thing I've ever done in my life. And that was the first time I had ever put together really a seminar. It was 6 months long. You had to go through it before you ever became a leader. And I translated that into the corporate world in 1988 when I decided to go into the workplace, because that's where people went every day rather than coming to see me maybe twice a month. And I began really from nothing. People told me I would starve to death. And I, because of spirituality in the workplace, they all said, wow, we really need it, but it's never going to work. Well, it did work. And for the last 31 years, it has become a business that has touched probably 50,000 people's lives and leaders' lives. And it's not about being religious at work. It's about being transformational. And those are the same qualities as being spiritual. It's about being flexible, fun, playful, strategic, caring, compassionate, you know, being more as much, if not more, concerned for your employees than your customer. Because if you care for your employees, your customers will always be cared for. So these were basic principles that just made sense to me. I wrote my first book, Leading from the Maze, about the labyrinth, published through 10 Speed Press in 1996. Went on to write Living Simultaneously, which is about work-life flow, not time management, but it's a quantum theory about how we can use flow as a life energy system rather than time management system. I wrote Habits of Heroes around 11 years ago, and that was based on mentorship. So this is how Jim and I came together, because I believe that mentoring is one of the most important elements that our culture needs so desperately. And we can't wait until people turn 65 or 70 to become mentors. The old boy network of the corporate world is appalling, because you get assigned someone who you never had a chance to choose. It's like having an assigned marriage. So in our program, you have to choose your mentor. And I put together 12 practices that were taught to me by remarkable people over my lifetime. And that's where the 12 practices have come from. So in a summer evening about 10 years ago, 11, we gathered at my farm every Thursday night for 12 weeks. And a group of people came together to talk about what they thought this practice might mean. And it was a wonderful conversation. Many married couples came, and people zoomed in on their computers who couldn't be there. And we had this marvelous in-depth dialogue about the meaning of mentoring and practices that would make a difference in the world. So that began that program and has been going on for many years. during my time of developing my own company, I had married a couple that where he went to work for this startup company. She said to me, they could really use your help, but they're just starting. They had 500 employees in one building in East Menlo Park, California. I went there and they said, we love what you're doing. We would like you to do 85% of our training, which I, of course, agreed because I was just starting my business. That was Cisco Systems. And John Morgridge was my first boss. I went on to work with John Chambers years later when he became CEO. And for now 29 years, Cisco has been a very dear client. And I am the last standing remnant of that past. Everyone else has moved on or retired. So Cisco has been a great partner. In fact, they have just purchased an enormous number of my journals that are coming out called The Year of Your Transformation, which are 365 of my quotes with reflections that is used in the Habits of Heroes, but it's also for mass distribution in the future. Companies like that, and I've had many, Hewlett-Packard has been another. Certainly, GoPro is currently one of those. Looking Glass, which is a cybersecurity company. Metromont, which has been and is a concrete company, precast concrete. And we've done a lot of work in that world as well as the high-tech world. So it's really been a fascinating smattering of people who are interested in real depth training that makes a difference, and I add the final tag that contributes to the greater good. I did a TED Talk 2 years ago, and it's on my book, which I have not finished, called From Great to the Greater Good, When Great is Not Good Enough. And so instead of always focusing on greatness and dominance, I'm calling our country back to goodness first, in the practice of goodness that then leads to greatness. So I'll stop there and let you ask some questions.
Sure.
Since I have gone on for a bit.
Well, that's quite a bit, and I'll let the other guys ask some questions too here in a second. But you mentioned a number of people that obviously influenced you over the years. Are there one or two people that stand out in leading you down this path?
Well, I'd have to say all 12 of them. they ranged from a Roman Catholic nun to a CEO to a couple of clergy and to actually a grandmother. So there's a blend. A mentor is different than a coach. And I consider myself counselor, mentor, coach. I've been trained and certified in counseling, which I've done for so many years. I have coached, as you know, thousands and thousands. And yet a mentor is someone who doesn't try to get you to any particular place. They accept you where you are. They show up, they care for you, and they don't set goals. They just love you. And you've chosen them because they enhance the qualities that in them that they're looking for. They live those qualities themselves. And so mentoring is that important element that we're doing, for instance, in West Virginia with 11th graders being taught the Habits of Heroes, teaching 9th graders, so that we start developing mentors way down in the system rather than waiting. As I said, we can't wait. So I find mentor qualities in so many people, and yet there have been some that have been just the absolute epitome of all of that.
No, I can imagine.
Well, you mentioned qualities of a mentor. By the way, this is Tony. So good to meet you. you mentioned the qualities of a mentor. What qualities stand out to you as key to being a good mentor?
Lack of judgment. So you're accepted for who you are, where you are, and that acceptance is what, if you read the book Culture Code, is what everyone in the corporate world and everyone in the world is looking for, and that is to belong. And when we belong in a relationship that does not have judgment and a critical voice, and you didn't do enough and you should have achieved more, then you're in a relationship where you can be at ease. And that's when the authentic self starts to come out. And that's one of the characteristics of a mentor. Humility is absolutely critical. And the greater good is the focus of the mentor, always wanting to serve, to be a part of volunteerism and giving back, making a difference, and not looking for assignations or awards that come with it. They do it very quietly, and that's part of the humility.
Hey, Jeff, this is Brian.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, so I spent quite a bit of time in the, the big corporate world in the Northern Virginia area. And so I'm curious how, when you first just start to work with some of these larger companies, in my experience, there was a lot of pressure from above. There was a lot of what felt like judgment. And, I'm a CPA, so you're always being judged on the work that you do. So when you're working with these leaders in those types of companies, and I imagine you run across quite a few leaders that you have to work with them in a way to maybe start to help them to realize different ways of working with their employees. So I guess what I'm thinking of is you've probably had a number of experiences that I'd love to hear about some of the more unique experiences with those corporate leaders that may have been a bit challenged in working this way and how you helped them, if there are any specific, good stories, good or bad, that you went through with some of them.
Oh, I have so many stories. How many hours was this podcast?
Did I just take up the rest of our time?
Oh my gosh, we could stay here for a couple hours.
I was going to say, I can shoot you a few names of people you probably need to call.
we may be a couple of them.
I have run into so many characters in the past. I finally got to the point where I didn't deal with difficult people who were closed anymore, because I had too many people wanting the transformational level that I didn't have to. I didn't have to deal with the ones when the boss said to me, "Hey, would you coach this guy? I mean, he is so bad." And back in the old days, I had to do it because I worked for the boss. But now I say, "Absolutely not. That's your job. But I'll teach you how to do it." So when I have observed people with styles that are so grounded in position, they are not open to, for instance, dialogue, which is building on the other person's idea, not judging, being patient in the process. That was David Bohm's work back in the 60s as a neuroscientist, who said that our brains worked and functioned at the highest level when we got rid of judgment. And we built on the other person's ideas. I teach people not to ever say yes, but to say yes, and it makes all the difference in the world. In neuroscience, the difference between cortisol, which is a negative in the back brain, and dopamine, which is in the front brain, all is related to the words that we use. And if I say but or no, your body responds one way. If I say yes and yes, you respond in another way. So there are some tricks in the new neuroscience, and I always encourage my leaders who work with me, they have to read books on the new neuroscience. Today in particular, the psychoneuroimmunology that is being sent out constantly about the current virus, the worst thing you can do is to be stressed. 90% of illness, according to Bruce Lipton in his book, The Biology of Belief, is due to stress. So if you want to be sick, be stressed. If you don't want to be sick, stop doing it. Part of stress is when you judge others because you're really being critical of something within yourself. I will ask people, "Hey, tell me about your parenting style. I'd love to know about your children." tell me about your relationship. And if they have similar styles, how's that working for you? And then they'll tell me all kinds of stories about their home life. But if it's an opposite style, I will say, have you thought of that in the workplace? Because people rise up to the greatest challenge through affirmation, through inspiration, through wisdom, not through the opposite of all that. And in bringing people forward, the energy of attraction is so much more attractive, basically, than dynamic energy, which is the sound of a siren, which is pushing people away. So there's a story. This is kind of the story that is of all stories. And this is the very short version. He was the worst CEO in Silicon Valley. I was asked by the board to work with him. I agreed to do it for free because I wanted to meet this guy. He had the most palatial office that you have ever seen in your lifetime. I walked in and he said, "What do you want?" And I said, I'm here to fix you. And he smiled and he said, "Oh, you're that coach, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He said, "Well, have a seat. Have a nice day. I've got real work to do." So he was not going to do anything with me. He agreed that I could come for the day, and that's all. He didn't say he'd work with me. So I watched him for 3 hours. He was so mean. He'd yell at people. People would cower when they came into his office. He threw his pen at his secretary, and they were called secretaries in those days. And he was just foul. So after 3 hours, he turned to me and said, "What is it you want from me anyway?" And I said, "Sir, I've been watching you for 3 hours. He said, "Yeah, I know." I said, "You're a deal maker, aren't you?" And he said, "You bet I am." I said, "I'll make a deal. What's the deal? If you answer one question, I'll leave." He said, "Hey, anything to get you out of here. What's the question?" I said, "What's the source of all your pain?" And he looked at me like, "You dirty bug." So he had to answer the question. He looked out the window for about 2 minutes and finally said, "Is this in confidence?" And I said, "Of course." Well, since then, about 500,000 people have heard this story, but that's because of the ending. He said, "When I was 16, I remember in particular my old man, he was a drunk. He always used to beat me around a bit, but one night he almost killed me, choked me, threw me toward the door, said, 'Get out. Your mother and I never wanted you. You're nothing but a bum. You'll never amount to anything. I never want to see you again.'" So he said, "I left." I went and stayed with my aunt that night, and I ended up living with her for a year. And my old man died, and he used horrible language, which, of course, I could never use on podcast. And it just showed his pain. So I stood up, and he stood up. He thought I was leaving, and I said, "Come here." And he asked, "Why?" And I said, "Come here." So with that really demonstrative voice, he cowered a bit. He came toward me. He stopped 3 feet away. I had to step up to him. I put my hands on his shoulder and I looked him in the eyes and I said, "Son, I just want you to know your mother and I love you so much and we are so proud of you." Well, he looked at me, his eyes widened, and I thought, "Oh God, what next?" And he began to tear up and then began to cry at such a level that he began to sob. And I held him. And he sobbed and sobbed. And the poor man, I had such compassion for the pain. He was 66 years old. Since the age of 16, for 50 years, he had been living with the shadow that he was a nobody. And so he proved to his old man, who had been dead all those 50 years, that he was somebody. But who had he become just like? His father. He was replicating, choking, throwing people, being mean, but he had a breakthrough that day. And he went on from there to do counseling, not with me, with someone else. He retired. And the reason I can tell the story is because when he retired, he went and became a volunteer in conflict resolution and helped nonprofits when they were arguing. And it was such a great story of transformation. Wow. That I can tell the story. And I went for years afterward. He and I were friends. I sailed with him in San Francisco Bay on his boat. And it was just a great resolution to pain. So when I encounter people who are just mean, or are fearful, so that they have to get results that are absolutely not viable or feasible. It's because they're driven by something that's deep down. And that's my pastoral background, of course. And I always go for the deeper driver of the behavior, which scares a lot of people to death because they know that I'm after them in a good way. And so therefore, when I encounter bosses who are just so tough, there's something driving that. And that becomes even more interesting to me than the other.
Yeah, that's
wow.
Pretty great.
Yeah,
that's powerful.
That is very powerful. So,
I think it's working in the workforce. I think it's very similar, I guess, to the home life. I think certain people are bosses the way they were brought up. At least that's how it was, and seemed to be in the large international accounting world. Partners act like the partners before them. I guess they felt like they got yelled at. They need to yell at somebody too. So.
Yeah. Well, Tony, that is why Socrates said, know thyself, the unexamined life is not a life worth living. When you inherit behavior because of mimicking, that just shows unconsciousness. And if I yell at my wife every day and I say, well, my father yelled at my mother, that's okay. That's not going to work for very long because that was a long time ago and it wasn't right then and it's not right now. So we have to wake up and sit quietly is the first practice of the habits of heroes. That's for the purpose of reflection. It's to learn about thinking strategically, yes, and to learn to just sit quietly and stop thinking for a moment and learn to listen. But it's also about journaling and looking at who you are, how you show up, hold a mirror in front of yourself and see what the world sees and start to change behavior. It's a fascinating science. It's called behavioral psychology, by the way, which we all know is so simple. But changing behavior is a challenge because neural pathways can get very deep. And, well, we've always done it this way. So that's always part of the church's problem or institutions that say that. And that's why they can atrophy after a while if they don't keep changing and being open two ideas.
No, that's absolutely true. And a couple of things you kind of touched on through there is belief. You know, if somebody believes something, whether it's positive or negative, that's sort of what comes out. And then the energy, and this is something that through an exercise we did when we first met with the energy sticks and sort of showing how it actually transposes itself onto other people. If you're really whether it's positive or negative, if you're really happy or whatever, those energy sticks open up and you can feel it from what 10 or 15 feet away. And it has an impact on people. Whereas if you come in as the mean old ogre and just yelling and just grumpy, or if you're that way every day, that same energy is given off. And just like you said, with words like, the no, but, or the, and yes, those little things make a big difference in body language and how people receive you. So it's very powerful. And then the belief itself. So anyhow, just a comment on that, not so much a question.
And Jim, you'll have to answer to your audience about energy sticks. I'm not going to say a word about that. Now you sound real woo-woo.
That caught my attention, and now I'm feeling like I'm missing out on something. I want an energy stick.
Well, that's one of my students, folks, and he's talking the woo-woo talk.
Yeah, well, I probably should have brought some of those to demonstrate, and maybe on another podcast I can, but they're at least energy sticks I'm referring to are like dowsing rods, and they're on a little swivel. So you hold them out, they come up and they're in a little sort of L shaped and you're holding them down. And depending on the energy of during the exercise, one person will hold the sticks and then the other person will be 8-10 feet away, sometimes further to start off with. And they think of either something very positive or something, you know, that really makes them upset. And then they slowly walk towards the person, and the dowling rods will either open up or close depending on what that energy is. And it almost never fails. And it's pretty, it's amazing and creepy at the same time, but it really demonstrates what your energy that you're giving off at all times.
Well, you know, everyone knows about people who can find water.
Yeah.
And right. At my farm, when I had the farm in Warrenton, Virginia, there was a guy who actually came with his wooden sticks and found where the well was to be. And we all say, yeah, oh yeah, that's marvelous. This is the same concept because energy is palatable and readable. And it's called in the, excuse me, in the world of science, morphic resonance. I am working with Rupert Sheldrake, who is one of the most brilliant scientists in the world. And he is helping me in some ways on my book, From Great to the Greater Good, because my belief is my theory, and he doesn't fully agree with this, so I can't, you know, say that he's 100% behind me, that if each of us individually will transform our energy field, because negative and positive are readable different fields. And so if we're negative, we will attract negative energy, including disease, et cetera. When we're positive, the dowsing rod show that it goes out. It's a dynamic energy that goes out, and it affects others. Stanford years ago did a research study in an auditorium. Half the auditorium was told to meditate for a half hour. The other half was told not to meditate, but just to observe the meditators. At the end of the half hour, all the meditators were tested with biorhythm and blood pressure and all that. Everything went down. They were so peaceful. The observers had the same result. They sat in the field of energy of the meditators. All of their blood pressure and biorhythms went down equally because they were in the field of those who were feeling peaceful. So we know now why we like positive people. We know why when we're with some particular person, we feel better. And the reverse, when we're with our negative people, how it drains us. Well, yeah, they're just drawing the life right out of you. So if you look up Rupert Sheldrake, and he wrote so many books, and he is so famous and so brilliant. He wrote, "Your dogs know when you're coming home." Well, how do dogs know when you're coming home? They do. People say, absolutely. My dogs would know when I landed at Dulles Airport, because my farm worker would tell me, what time did you land? And that's when all the dogs start dancing around and playing. They knew that you were on your way home. So that field of energy can be extended way beyond just the couple of feet around us. It can be much bigger through our own internal projection, values, beliefs, clarity that comes through knowing who we are. And we become the kind of people that change the world. If I were to take the time to ask you who has been a mentor for you and why, you would describe many of these characteristics. They were the kind of person where you felt peaceful, safe, in the presence of wisdom, not judged. They were kind. They were humble. They were always on time and paid attention to detail, perhaps. There's so many characteristics that go on. And yet, you would not know or say it's because when I was within their energy field, I felt different and I loved it. I'll stop there.
No, it's definitely powerful.
Yeah, that is. So I have a question. We're Friends That Carry On. We like travel. We're not doing any of that right now for obvious reasons, but this seems to probably could be very useful as we and our listeners are traveling and meeting other people and other cultures around and, you know, in different countries and different parts of the world, and how they interact with people that they're meeting, and whether or not you are coming across as someone that, you know, maybe has a good energy field. That I just wondered if you had any tips for us or for our listeners in regards to maybe, you know, good ways to interact, good ways to speak with someone when you first meet them, and you're in a different culture, and maybe you're a little bit nervous, or you're uncomfortable or a little anxious in a situation.
Yeah, that's a great thought, Tony. I could write a blog about that.
That was Brian, by the way. Tony does not get credit for that question.
All right, Brian.
I was going to steal that.
That's right. This is Tony's computer. I think that, you know, energy is a universal language. And when language becomes a barrier, our very presence can say to someone, I need help. That happened to me in South America. I was in Brazil and no one spoke any English. And I was in the airport and I didn't know what to do. I started to feel a little bit frantic because I was in São Paulo and I was to be picked up by a Cisco driver and no one was there. And I caught hold of that. I said, look, you are projecting the wrong energy. So just get with it. And I stood in the middle of this enormous airport and changed my attitude. And I attracted this woman who I didn't even know where she was. She just came out of nowhere. She said, in perfect English, sir, you look like you're lost. May I help you? And I looked at her and thought, wow, this stuff really works. This is really great. And she helped me perfectly. And I finally got to where I was going. So I think that, you know, travel can be so disruptive. And I have learned on airplanes how to not get sick through energy. And yes, I use some tinctures. I always use a nasal spray of ocean spray, which is just salt, and it helps clean stuff out, all that. But energy is so much more important because it can actually create a space around you that is like an envelope. And if you don't want to be disturbed, which I don't like to talk to the person next to me because it always gives me a neck ache after a while, you can actually create an energy that says I'm fully involved and I'm not communicating today without being, you know, mean or anything. But you also can create a protective energy that just says I am well. I love to travel. This is a marvelous airline. I wish they still serve food, but I'm glad I brought my sandwich. You know, anything that actually helps the attitude. Because I feel for flight attendants who have to deal today with so many people who are so outrageous and have an attitude of they deserve something more than what they've paid for. And instead, you know, we always say that honey attracts the bees. The nice people are the ones who are kind and generous are the ones who usually can get the most help. I took my daughters to Kauai for a week when they were younger, and we got up to, this was our big week, and the person at the desk said, I'm sorry, sir, we have no reservation for you. And I said, what? I mean, here I've made, you know, all these arrangements and this is our trip. And how could this be? She said, and we're oversold and I'm so sorry. And I said, well, you know how important this is for our children and my children. And I know that you'll do your best. So she said, please have a seat. So after about 15 minutes, I heard my name called and I went up and she said, sir, here are your seats. I said, well, thank you so much. So we're walking into the 747 and the girls start to turn right. And I said, no girls, turn left. We're in first class.
Oh, wow.
We got the most beautiful flight from San Francisco to Kauai. And then we get to our hotel and the woman at the desk said, would you be interested in just having the penthouse? Wow. And we looked at each other and said, oh, of course, we would love to. No extra cost. It was all glass on top of this building overlooking the beach in Kauai. And we just, of course, had the most marvelous week. So we still laugh about that today, about just having an attitude. Years ago, I had a similar travel experience. I went up to the person at the desk, and I said, I have a problem. I just met one of my friends from my company where I work, and he's in first class, and I'm of course in coach because I never fly first class. And she looked at me like, don't even ask. And I said, would it be possible for him to join me in coach? Because he's willing to do that. He was such a great guy. And she looked at me like, are you kidding? He's willing to come out of first class and sit next to you and coach? And I said, he's really a great guy. And we wanted to sit together so we could talk. So she said, again, let me see what I can do. And a couple of minutes later, we both had first class tickets. So we sat and enjoyed the flight. But see, if I had asked the other way, it never would have happened. And by stepping back with humility and asking for less, we got more, which is one of the keys to life. Less is more.
Now that's so true. And as Brian brought up cultures, and I know there's another little culture type thing that you use in some of the mindfulness lessons, which I think is more on showing up, which we won't go into that detail, but it had to do with the Eskimos. I don't know if this is a good time to bring up how Eskimos greet each other or not, but with the culture and different things, I thought maybe it might be sure. Apropos.
Yeah, the Inuits are amazing people of wisdom. And for instance, if you have a grievance against your neighbor, you go before a jury like we do. But in their culture, you have to argue your opponent's position, and your opponent argues your position. And rarely does the jury ever have to make a decision, because you come to an understanding by being in the other person's shoes. When it comes to socialization, when the guest arrives at the door for dinner, the guest says, I am here. And the host says, I am here too. Our culture, we often say, hey, come on in. I'm not ready. I've got to fix yourself a drink, make yourself at home. I've still got things to do. I even went to dinner once and someone said, hey, come on in. I got to go to Safeway. I forgot to get something. But, I thought, wow, that is such a difference from the people who say, I am here too. So I have taught that story for so many years that I have corporate bosses who start their meeting, all their staff meetings, by saying, I am here. And when everyone finally responds, I am here too, that means they put away their laptops, they've stopped thinking about all their stuff, they are totally present, and they have just shown up. And the boss doesn't start the meeting until that is clear. Instead of dealing with the distractions that we do all the time in meetings when everyone is doing everything but listening to the moderator.
That makes me just think so much about, and I think we as Americans, a lot of times we're probably rightly so stereotyped with that type of an attitude where we go somewhere and we're so intent on what it is that we're doing, we're not there. All we're doing is thinking about, okay, how can I get this done? How can I get to do what it is that I want to do? And the way we're interacting with people, and we try to talk with our listeners about traveling in a way, in a courteous way, in a kind way. And that story that you were just talking about there really struck me, to come to it with an attitude of I am here. So whether you can speak their language or not, the body language and the eye contact and the way of presenting yourself to say that I am here, I can see how that could really help. And I think I'm going to take that with me for quite a while.
That's wonderful. Yes, we can use the outside skills, the external skills of eye contact, the tone of our voice, our posture, all of those things say something visually. But when we do the internal work of really being there, of seeking help or connection with humility, not with arrogance, like you demand something, you change that particular part of the world at that moment, and you'll watch the benefits that come. It's astounding. So it's very, very important. Distraction, there are three major issues the Habits of Heroes deals with: distraction, deception, and disintegration. And so distraction, we all know about it. We have become so distracted that our ability to focus is now 7 seconds. It used to be 11 seconds, but we have dropped 4 seconds in the last 10 years. A goldfish, in comparison, can focus for 9 seconds. So we have dropped below the ability of goldfish. So there you go. So when people pick up their phone or look at a text or check their email when we're meeting, I look at them like, are you kidding? I expect total presence because that's what I offer. And if I can't offer it because I'm tired or I'm not feeling well or something's wrong, if I can't clear it, I will make for another time when I can completely show up. So I think we're really rude when we don't give our full self. And I do this with my wife all the time. She loves to start asking all the questions she's had all day when the news starts. So I sit down to watch the news, and thank God we can freeze the newscast because I do it around 20 to 25 times per half hour cast because she has another question. And I think, okay, sweetheart, I can always watch the news later. And it's very important rather than saying, can't you see I'm watching the news? Because that doesn't go very well. So deep down, she's saying, I really would like to be with you and I need your attention. And so I guess I figure out other ways to do that. Deception. We have become a culture of lies and no one trusts anyone. And that's when community falls apart. And that's why disintegration starts to happen. So I am so committed to the practice of goodness, to the greater good, to giving back, to making a difference, to leaving a legacy that is not anything I'm defining, because my only legacy is a tombstone that says he was blessed and did bless. And that is from one of the great poets from England. I've just grabbed one of his lines. That's all I care about having people say about me is that he blessed others by his presence. He didn't leave money. He didn't do this, didn't do that, but he blessed us. That's it.
Well, and that's impactful. That's powerful.
Yeah, obviously we are a travel podcast. So, I mean, we were talking about this a little bit, that whole about being present. I think we brought it up really in kind of a conversation about photography, but I've had this conversation too, just about the travel itself. You have so many people who kind of go on their once of a lifetime trip or something they've always wanted to do. And then when they're on the trip, they're too busy doing something else or taking phone calls or complaining about the service of the waitress or whatever it may be. I'm like, you just saved up for 3 years to come over here and just enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, and in your example with photography, just constantly taking pictures and not
so busy taking pictures so we can share it with our Snapchats and Instagram that we don't enjoy what we're actually taking a photograph of. So I think being present is very, very meaningful when it comes to travel as well.
Well, you can't do that until you learn how to practice it every day. So my days start at 4 a.m. every day. And from 4 a.m. to 6:30, sometimes 7, that's my time to sit quietly. I contemplate, I reflect, I pray, I read, I study, I journal in 5 different journals, and I also write. That's my really creative time. So by the time noon comes around, I've really done a full day, and I always take a nap in the afternoon, sometimes 2, sometimes I get up at 3. And that means that when I go into an experience like travel or going to Italy or going, places where we've wanted to go, I don't let distractions get in the way. Like, leave your phone at home. Or don't even bring a camera, take the pictures with your brain and remember, or journal about it and then talk about it. There are other ways, but you see, when people are so distracted every day by their regular life, they don't know how to do it when they go to travel. And the reason they've gone to travel is to experience something new, and they don't really fully experience it because they are still being interrupted by their own distractions that they cultivate every day in their regular life.
So are you practicing your 4 a.m. to 6 a.m. meditation writing when you travel as well?
Oh, yeah, I do. It's just because it's in my DNA. You know, I wake up. I mean, once the jet lag is over and you're back on track, yeah, that early morning, my wife and I went to Italy not long ago, and I would sit and look out at the coast with great coffee in the morning and just ponder. It was just, that was some of my favorite parts of the travel. It was taking in the environment through visualization and looking and listening and smelling and all the things that happen around you. Without, and I never took one picture, never. I don't even have a camera.
I can tell you, Jeff, from the sessions I've sat in with you and sort of going back to lesson one, sitting quietly and what you've talked about. Now, I don't do it for several hours in the morning like you do, and maybe I should, but I do take those moments and do the breathing and really quiet my mind. Or if I've been really stressed out with work or whatever, I'll just, you know, divorce myself from what's going on and sit down for 20 minutes or half hour to try to get my thoughts together. And it is amazing how the answer sort of comes to you. Now, in regards to travel, I've kind of done the same thing in the moment, whether it's a beautiful landscape or seascape or a historic building, just sort of taking that very deep breath and just soaking in the moment. And it makes it that much more, at least for me, that much more powerful. So I appreciate having learned that from you.
Jeff, this is Walt. And the one thing I'm hearing from you and the one thing I've seen with Jim since he's been with you is I think you, I don't know, on purpose, teach an intentional living situation where you're kind of focused and your life is more intentional or purposeful because you're paying attention.
Is that a question?
Well, it's kind of an observation, but oh. I think that's kind of what I'm hearing and seeing, you know, with Jim and in our relationship through your relationship with Jim. So,
yes, and he's become more handsome since you first met.
You know what, Jeff? You're absolutely right.
And that took a lot of work.
Wouldn't you say there really wasn't a way to go the other direction?
Well, that could be.
It's the relaxed look on his face.
Right.
Yeah. This is part of sitting quietly. It's awakened desire with persistent intention. So when we have a wake-up call, we have to be very intentional, persistently, about changing behavior. Do you know that 9 out of 10 heart transplant recipients do not change their behavior after receiving a heart transplant?
It's amazing.
So people are so into their routine and just will not. You have to really work at being intentional. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do my practices 7 days a week, 365 days a year. I don't take weekends off because it's like saying I don't breathe on weekends. No, it's a part of who we are. And then it becomes more of our fabric, and then it becomes the way in which we act most of the time, not all the time. And that's when we can teach others. And that's why Jim can serve and does serve as a mentor to others, because he's practicing. And that's why I called these the 12 practices, because when you practice enough, it becomes a habit. That's the level of unconscious competence. So we move from the lowest level of unconscious incompetence, where a lot of the world is, they have no idea what they do. You move them to the level of conscious incompetence by pointing it out, especially if you're a coach. Third level is conscious competence, where they start to coach themselves because they've been taught, like the golf pro taught me how to change my grip. Until you practice so much, it's unconscious competence. It's just natural. You never have to say to me, please listen to me. Listening has been my life. And it's the number one leadership skill determined by Harvard of 25 skills. It's number one for great leaders. You have to listen, but I add to it you also have to hear. Don't just practice the skills of active listening and all that stuff people teach. Hear it. Are you really hearing what people are saying? Which means you've gotten rid of your defenses. You're not willing to take a position, to challenge them, to you know, say, yeah, but do you hear them? And that is a beautiful gift that we can give to anyone. That comes through practice, persistence, and which it becomes ultimately a habit. You know, I just wrote a blog on this. The humans live by laws, but nature lives by habits. There are no laws in nature. You know, when springtime comes, it's the planet has been doing this for a long time. It's habitual. And when we do things enough, no one has to say, okay, it's spring. Start budding those leaves. Start doing this. Daffodils come up. It's habitual. So that's, humans can do the same. It just takes a lot of work and it's worth it.
No, absolutely. And it reminds me of a story you've told, an anecdote you told, and I hope you'll share it here. Speaking of a person who has been very intentional in what they're trying to do and practices on a regular basis, and they end up transforming their neighborhood and their area. And I know you heard about this lady on the radio. Somehow, I think you were in California and she was in Detroit. And you flew out to see her or to find out about her. Can you share the story of, I don't know if it's Mama Joe or Mama G. Mama G, that's it.
Yeah, Mama G was on Fresh Air with one Sunday morning. And I heard her, she was in 6 Mile in Detroit. If you know Detroit, 6 Mile is deep down in the dark kind of bad section, at least used to be. And everyone was behind closed doors. They had locked up. No one was on the streets. And she was marching by herself with her own sign saying, we have to claim our neighborhood. She'd go out to the drug dealers on the corner who were all kids who grew up there, bring them cookies. And they'd say, go home, Mama G. You're going to get killed. This is dangerous out here. Well, she didn't give up. So I heard this story and I went to see her. And here was this 5 foot ball of radiant energy that welcomed me at the door, and I fell in love. She was a 78-year-old woman. She was as wide as she was tall, and her eyes and teeth just blazed life. And I'll never forget, I can see her right now looking at me. So I spent 3 hours with her. She told me since the radio interview, she had formed a basketball team. And I said, well, that's wonderful. She said, we have 7 boys. And I said, well, that is fantastic. Who's coaching? She said, oh, I coach. And I said, well, who refs the game? She said, oh, I ref. And now you can picture this little ball of human running up and down at the age of 78, blowing a whistle with these 7 boys that she had collected. Well, I said, what can I do for you? She said, we need uniforms and we don't want those cheap cotton ones. And I said, okay, Mama, you are my kind of girl. I'll get you silk ones and give me their names. I'll even have the names put on. So I spent a fortune on these and sent them back. They sent me back, of course, a picture and say, they called me father. They called me Mr. Jeff. That's right, Mr. Jeff. And they said, thank you so much. And now we have like 28 people in our league. And I said, that's great. You're not getting the same uniforms. So I went back, but the part of the story was, and that Jim wants me to tell, is when I first went to see her, I couldn't find her home. And I had turned down the street that I thought was maybe her street. And not only was no one there, there was no grass. Everything was dirt in front of these row houses, except for her house, which was this one beautiful green patch. So I knew it was her house. I went there and I said, yep, figures. Well, when I went back to see her 2 years later, because I wanted to see how everything was going and it was going so beautifully, I turned the corner and guess what? I stopped and I began to weep because every lawn was beautiful green grass, flowers, people sitting on their porches, young families wheeling their children in their strollers, and life had come back to that block and perhaps that whole neighborhood. So it was a story of transformation of this one tiny little powerhouse who said, I will make a difference. Now, Dolores Huertas is one of the voices in The Habits of Hero. She started the United Farm Workers with Cesar Chavez, who is her brother-in-law. And if you want to meet another dynamo in this world who's still at it, and she is, well, I think she's 88 at this point, she still, every day, is working tirelessly for those who are underserved and depressed. And so we can be that kind of light, but we have to do our work within, because radiance comes from within. And when it's there, we know it. And people who have done their work will actually participate in that energy, in that attitude, that belief system, whatever you want to call it. And that's when change begins to happen. So I continue on to do the little things that I do to try to make that difference in the world. And if we all did it through morphic resonance or through the practice of goodness, think how we could change the world from that energy on the outside, which can actually start to affect the behavior of those who are not behaving well. And that's really the theory of morphic resonance that I didn't get into, that Rupert Sheldrake's theory is it has more influence than our DNA. So that when we step into that energy field, no matter how we've been brought up, what kind of genetic DNA we have that may be inclined toward violence or whatever, it will start to change us whether we like it or not. So that's where I grabbed onto that and said, okay, let's get a few hundred million people practicing and let's see what happens.
Oh yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And it's powerful. So you can see what one person like Mama G does. And then if you do this and the works Jeff's been doing and so forth, it can be a powerful thing.
All the dirt to grass and flowers.
Right.
That's right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Jeff, you have a number of things going on. Obviously, you head up the Patnode Group, but you also run the Wingspan Foundation. Can you talk about some of the projects you got going on? I know you have some stuff going on in North Carolina with some of the jail system there. And mm-hmm. I know you're working with some people in Cleveland. Can you share some of the groups you're working with and what you're doing there?
Yeah. In addition to West Virginia and the high school program that we've talked about, which I think is in its fourth or fifth year, it's still in an experimental stage. And that is so pleasing to be in public schools. And our hope is that the public schools will pick up this program throughout the country. But we want West Virginia to be the pilot and the icon for this, because that would be a great success story. I'm working with an organization in Raleigh-Durham called Coalition, who are working with homeless, because I've always worked with homeless people. They are selecting 50 people every 6 months to teach them culinary skills. And they not only teach them how to become chefs, they find them jobs to become chefs. So they are learning the habits of heroes, or it hasn't started yet, but will, in order to have life skills that go with their culinary skills. Now, in another part of North Carolina, there are 450 inmates in three counties that are released every month. And traditionally, they're let off in front of the courthouse. They really have no place to go. They have very little money, often do not have family contacts. And so you can see why they return back to jail, because at least it's safe. So we are working now on funding of me teaching executive mentors like Jim has been taught, so that we hire 12 people who have been just currently released, who have been through psychological profile and testing, because we choose people who can truly serve as mentors. And then they each have a group of 64 that they mentor virtually or in person. So we handle every month those people being released. So every month, that means I train 12 people to be the executive mentors, and then they go off for a year to teach this program. So we work with dispossessed, whether it's homeless or incarcerated. We add to that healthcare workers, which has been on our list for years, and currently, who needs it more? Of course, they don't have the time, but this is something that, that will emerge as a result of this crisis, how our healthcare workers are people who are so critical to our systems that we have probably taken for granted until now. So we hear the stories every day, the cheering crowds, they have become the new superhero of our culture. And we have forever wanted to be with them to help teach them ways in which their resilience can be sustained. Transitioning veterans and single parents are on that list, and police officers. So the San Francisco police chief, Bill Scott, asked me 2 years ago, can you please train our 2,200 officers so that they can be more of a guardian than a warrior? And I said, you bet, as long as we can find the funding, because the San Francisco cannot pay for it, we're trying to find the funding. We're still working toward it now to train all those police officers in a new way of thinking, which could also be a pilot for the entire nation. So those are some of the things that Wingspan is doing.
Wow.
In addition, so I write children's books all the time. I'm up to actually 33 at the moment. Many are being published now, and the artists are working on them because they're called parentables, parables for parenting. They're written to the parent as well as the child, because what's a better place to start than with our children and parents with their children?
So how can people find Wingspan and help support?
Wingspanfoundation.org is our website.
And we're going to put all that up. Okay. So, well, Jeff, we're winding down on our time. It has been very enjoyable to have you on, always enlightening. And I think our listeners will get a lot out of this. And from our Octave Hospitality and Travel Advisors group, we are going to be, some of our lessons are actually coming from Jeff's. He's willingly allowed us to pull a couple of the lessons, like sitting quietly, to offer that to our people we'll be working with. But also, we're going to be putting Jeff's resources up on our websites and so forth, so that you can reach out to Jeff. You can also go to the patnaude.com, which is patnaude.com, which is Jeff's website, and it has not only courses and programs you can take, but a bookstore and different stuff if you want to get any of his reading materials. And he's got his new journal, The Year of Your Transformation, which is a daily journal, which has quotes from him and meditations and so forth. Jeff, do you want to speak on the journal real quick before we wrap up?
Well, this was a product of my daughters and my dear wife. They took 365 of my quotes from my previous works, books, blogs, wherever. I don't know. I don't even recognize the quotes, but I know that I wrote them. And they published, unbeknownst to me, this hardcover called The Wisdom of Our Father. And they each wrote three times in three different sections of it. And it was very beautiful and very touching. I went on to expand it to add the reflections over a two-year period, because I just listened to wisdom and just typed. I don't take any credit for it. And now it's being published in leather-bound, gold-leaf, beautiful 400-page copy that you can use as a daily journal. Every day one, day two, it doesn't have a date. It just goes according to days, with a quote. A lot of them are business quotes about being better leaders and managers, and a reflection that goes with it. I think, really, of all the things I've written, and again, I don't take credit for it, it's the most fascinating work ever that I probably will ever create, because it's just, it leads you, it follows the labyrinth. It's the way in, which is part one, the center, which is the place of illumination, part two, and then the journey outward, which is part three. And it really most likely will change people's lives if they actually do it for 365 days. So that's going to be available probably around June 1st or July 1st. It's in process right now.
Great. Well, that sounds like a great book, a powerful book full of wisdom. And we'll make sure that our listeners and followers will know how to get that when it's ready. Well, Jeff, that wraps us up for today. Thank you so much for your time. like I said before, lots of wisdom and good stuff there, and we really appreciate it. From Brian, Walt, Tony, and myself, Jim, this concludes this week's episode of Friends That Carry On and our introduction to Octave Hospitality Advisors as well. And you can find us at friendsatcarryon.com and octavehospitality.com. Thank you all.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
Be sure to join the Friends next week for another great discussion. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. You can also find the Friends and other content at www.friendsatcarryon.com or check us out on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook by searching Friends That Carry On. Thanks again for joining us, and don't forget to carry on, friends.